So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is December 13th, 2017. And I've been reflecting a lot about a variety of things, both the holiday season and some of the tension or pressure people describe around dealing with things, including relatives, and then also the political situation we're in really broadly. And one of the things that gets stirred up for people around those things is a sense of helplessness. A sense of what can I do, or the need is so great, what I can contribute is so small, or no matter what I do, my mom, my daughter, my son, my father, my whoever is still just going to do that thing that drives me crazy. A sense of like, ugh, what can I do? And first and foremost, we can be with the experience of that. Much as the Buddha taught, we can be mindful of the experience. We can explore its qualities, and in particular, we can have insight into the experience of frustrated, exasperated, irritation, worry, anticipatory dread, all the rest of that. So we can be with it as an experience, and also in particular, as he taught, this is extremely important, we can have insight into its nature as experience, which is the nature of all experience, as transient, impermanent, made up of many parts, arising dependently, insubstantial, and in a fundamental sense, ownerless. So experience is a local expression of a vast impersonal process. And in the seeing of that, there's a gradual letting go of reactivity to any kind of experience, pleasant or unpleasant. It's there. We do what we can to guide it in beneficial ways for ourselves and other people, but we start to disidentify from experience and become freer in our relationship to it. That's certainly a profoundly important thing to do with any kind of experience. Additionally, there are a variety of practices that are suggested for working with experience, not simply being with it even in a profound way. And one of the ways to work with experience or to work with feelings of helplessness is to explore what it's like to make an offering. And I want to tell a story about that. So I had a friend of mine many, many years ago named David who was he was training to become a Zen priest. And this was very important to him. It was very sacred to him. And he was about to give his first talk at San Francisco Zen Center. And we were at a party in a back room sitting next to each other. And I admit there was a little jealousy that arose in me and about, he gets to be special and important. And I said to him a little provocatively something that I'd read in the newspaper, that a number of people who were homeless in San Francisco would come into the Zen Center because it was warm there and safe and there was free coffee or donuts. And they didn't have any particular interest in the Dharma. So I said that to him. How's it feel to know that there are going to be people in the room who could really care less about what you're talking about? My internal thought balloon right now is, what an asshole. Anyway. But he looked at me like I didn't get it, because obviously I didn't. And then he did something I've thought about countless times ever since. We were sitting opposite each other on two separate beds with a little aisle in between, talking, and he made a gesture at my feet like this. Not dismissively, not like he was throwing something away, more like he was just laying something at my feet. And he said, Rick, I just make the offering. After that, it's out of my hands, and it's up to them what they do. I make the offering. And he said, I try to come up with a good talk. I knew him as a very intelligent writer and poet and someone who cared deeply about what he was doing. So he brought a work ethic to it. He said, I try to come up with a good talk and slip in a few jokes to keep people interested. But really, that's my job. And after that, I had kind of an imagined visual that he was just putting something on the river, and the river then would just carry it away. And what would happen next was out of his hands. I make the offering. After that, it's up to them, not me. And he wasn't dismissive. There was no lack of responsibility in him. And in fact, because he wasn't trying to shove some kind of idea in the minds of others or control what their response was, the odds actually were greater that there'd be more receptivity to what he had to say. I just make the offering. And I think about applying that to our response to the situations we're in at all scales. How do we respond to the pain in our body, or aging, or illness, or in that in others? Well, we can make an offering. We make the offering of our efforts. We make the offering of our applications. We make the offering of our practice. How do we respond to society altogether? Well, in our own corner of the world, we make the offering we can. We offer what we can. That's a very peaceful and responsible way to relate to things. The peacefulness in it is that there's a kind of acceptance that so many of the causes that determine outcome do not have our name on them. So peacefulness there. There's also a responsibility to make the offering that we can. And I think of lines from Leonard Cohen, who's saying, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in. Pretty profound, right? So I'd like to explore with you tonight what it's like to relate to many situations as a matter of making an offering, offering what we can, and being at peace with what happens. Ajahn Chah, the teacher, no longer alive, in Thailand, great, great practitioner, teacher of Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and many others. So we're kind of in the lineage of his wisdom stream. He had a story. He said in the rural setting of Thailand, simple people would come to the temple, farmers. He said, you know, if you want some fruit, you can go and get a little tree, a little sapling. You can pick a good one. You can find a good place to put it, dig a good hole, plant it really well, fertilize it well, water it well. As the years go by, you can protect it from the sun, the insects. You can prune it carefully. You can keep watering it. But you cannot make it give you an apple. You can tend to the causes. You can make the offering of tending to the causes. You can nourish the causes, but you cannot control the results. Isn't that quite a profound distinction? Tend to the causes, be at peace about the results. For example, we can love our children, we can encourage them, we can try to manage our own reactions, we can do the best we can, but we cannot make them be happy. We can take care of the body. We can eat good food. We can exercise. We can try to stay out of too much trouble with the body. But we can't prevent it, in many times, from acquiring an illness, a condition of some kind. So we tend to the causes, but we cannot control the results. We can be kind to someone. We can love them dearly. We can be careful in our way of being with them. But we cannot make them love us. That's their offering to give. So I'm going to take that to another step and quote, as you may have heard me, this little boy from South Africa, Nkosi Johnson, born with HIV in the early 80s, died around the age 12. Before he died, he became an advocate for children and adults, people in general, with HIV. And to paraphrase him, close paraphrase, he had a saying I've thought about many times as well. He says, do all that you can with what you've been given in the place where you are with the time that you have. Right. Make the offering, tend to the causes, what will be, will be. One way to think about making our offering is interpersonal. And this year, as we kind of wrap it up, we've been exploring mindfulness and practice really in the field of relationships. And in relationships, very often, there's a tendency to want to make something happen in the mind of the other person, to persuade them, to convince them, to get them to see us a different way, or to see us in a more flattering way, or a more affirming way, to understand that it was really their fault all along. To believe that the proper way to load a dishwasher is this way, not that way. And yet, wow, so much suffering, so much contentiousness comes from that. And I'll just tell you a story. So somehow, many years ago, I got invited to be on the board at Spirit Rock Meditation Center. And I had some background in Buddhism, but at that time, it was about 20 plus years ago, but not an enormous amount of background. But I found myself on this board. And I started watching the teachers, the Spirit Rock teachers on the board, about half teachers, half people like myself. And I had a business background, and I was used to work environments or board environments where you would try to make your case. And you wouldn't be a jerk about it, but you would make your case. And I watched them do something really different. There'd be a complicated issue about which people might very legitimately have strong and divergent opinions. And one person would offer their view, articulate, weighty. Then a second person would offer their view, which was 180 degrees opposed. They'd offer it respectfully, firmly, clearly, weightily. And then I would wait for the first person to counterattack, to rebut, as it were. I was trained as a debater in high school. It came to me naturally. And I was like waiting, and they wouldn't do it. They just would nod, and then the conversation would move on to the third person and the fourth person who would offer their view. And what I watched and began to see, surprisingly, is that the people who were offering their views were not being left behind. I mean, they were saying what needed to be said, but they weren't getting contentious about it. They weren't quarreling about it. They made their offering. They respected what they had to say. They laid it out there. And after that, it was out of their hands. They might later on say another thing or make a wry joke or something like that, but there wasn't that kind of quarrelsome stickiness, Velcro-like contentiousness, round and round and round and round, that people often can get into. And there, too, I think that's a way to think about what would it be like if you think about some difficult relationships or sort of an ongoing framework in which there's some contentiousness. If you reframed what you're doing as you make your offering and then they do what they do. It's not framed as a screw you. It's respectful, it's caring, it's kind, it's the best you can do. Maybe you go back and forth a bit. But fundamentally, you're at ease with it. You've offered it. It's been a gracious gift. They do what they do. What would that be like? I've quoted often this particular passage that has stuck in my mind, as certain phrases or passages do. This is from the Buddha, as best we guess. He says, "One is not wise because one speaks much. One is wise who is peaceable, friendly, and fearless." Peaceable, friendly, and fearless. So I think of the fearlessness of making the offering, calling it like we see it, not pulling our punches, not muzzling ourselves, not watering down our truth, being willing to speak truth to power with a certain fearlessness. And yet in that as well can be a peaceableness and even a friendliness. I think of the Dalai Lama's statement. And just imagine the context here. His line was, "My friends, the enemy Chinese." Now, he's not really referring to the Chinese people. He's really speaking of the Chinese government that's oppressed his country for 60, 70 years at this point now. But he can hold both those things. He recognizes that they're an adversary. He's a major thorn in the side of arguably the second, if not the most powerful, really, country in the world today. He's a major thorn in their side, and yet he's also peaceable, friendly, and fearless, and he can regard them, and they've flattened his country. Roughly 1 million Tibetans have died in the process of the Chinese occupation over the years. Hundreds of temples destroyed. Terrible things, terrible things. And yet he can look at them and say, my friends, my adversaries, the Chinese government. It's quite profound to think about that, even and then brought down to the scale of our family relationships, our friendships, our communities, our companies, our organizations. Okay. And then I want to offer two kind of notions about how to make the offering that may be a little counterintuitive. One of them, the first of them, is around playfulness. People can become, I can definitely become very serious, very dogged, and self-important about my offering. And I think it's great to just keep in mind a quality of play, which has a certain sense of creativity, a lightness to it, kind of a recognizing that really at the end of the day, it's not such a big deal. Quoting Bill Murray here, that great Dharma teacher. He said, I realized the more fun I had, the better I did. Fun. I was talking just a day or two ago with a teacher in the Shambhala lineage, the Tibetan lineage, about maybe doing something together. So I kind of laid out my project, this retreat I will be teaching next summer at the Shambhala Mountain Center. And I laid out all this hardcore neurodharma, esoteric, neat stuff. And he just listened and listened and listened and listened. And then I stopped and I said, so what do you think? He said, sounds like fun. I thought, we're in. It's my kind of guy. I was checking him out. He was checking me out. Yeah, let's do this together. This sounds like fun. That's good. So fun, a playfulness. And I just invite you to think about that in terms of just how you are with people. It can get so heavy and stuck and gluey sometimes interpersonally. And to just think about a lot of what we do as play. As play. We're making the offering in a playful way. Not falsifying the seriousness sometimes of the undertaking, but keeping in mind a certain twinkle in the eye, a certain lightness, a kind of playfulness. And one of the nice things about play, a little neurology here, is that it heightens what are called neurotrophic factors in the brain. These are chemical systems in the brain that promote the formation of structure based on the experiences that are occurring at the time, which is a complex way of saying, if you want to help yourself gain as much as possible from the experiences you're having, bring a playfulness, meet them with a playfulness while you're having them. You're going to learn more. They're going to sink in more. The lessons are going to land more. The internalized benefits of accumulating greater compassion or determination or gratitude or inner peace or lovingness, those experiences, those traits will develop more inside you if you have a playfulness also occurring in your mind as you experience them. So playfulness. And then the essence of play, it's the second and last kind of suggestion I'll have here, is something I've been just really exploring more and more in my own experience. And in the process of exploring into my own experience, I, as I often do, go back and forth between my experience and then my sense of the state of mind of people who are very far along the path, including people who are really awakened or very, very close to it. And kind of what's it like to be them, and then kind of reverse engineering my growing approximation or movement in that direction. And the quality I want to call out for you is what it feels like to have delight, to be delighted, to delight. If you look closely at that, when you're in a state of delight, it's like ego falls away, contraction falls away. It's just delight. You're sort of surprised. Surprise, by the way, also heightens the gaining from the experiences that we're having. We're delight. And I think even in the moment of meeting, entering the next moment endlessly, so this moment falls away and the next moment arises, and to the extent that you have any sense of that, there's a sense of delight. Like, wow, wow, right? Child mind, beginner's mind, Zen mind, as the saying has it. Just it's both, you could say, terrifying that this present moment vanishes beneath our feet continuously. It can feel very alarming, like, whoa. And a lot of, by Mother Nature's design, our neuropsychology is this futile and stressful and saturated with suffering, even subtle suffering, attempt to hold on to what is endlessly vanishing. The experience is endlessly ending. It's kind of horrifying in ways, or scary, to get that part. But the other side of it is the extraordinary delight at the next thing that's arising. Yes, there is a continuous ending, but there's a continuous beginning in which we can delight. And even most deeply and profoundly, we can delight in the space of unconditioned possibility within which, out of which, the next moment of conditioned actuality appears to disappear endlessly. That's how it really is, isn't it? And to kind of move to an end here, there's a quotation from the Buddha that I just think is awesome. So background context, in the traditions of his time, there was a lot of interest in fire, ritual fires. And the ultimate meaning of the word nirvana or nibbana is extinguished like a fire. It's gone out for lack of fuel. It's not been suppressed, it's just simply gone out. So, and here when he talks about the world, he's talking about the world of experience. So here's the passage. The entire world of experience is in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the awakened ones, where death has no entry, because if nothing arises, nothing passes away. In that, my mind delights. I'm going to read it again. The entire world is in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the noble ones, the awakened ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. So to finish here is a kind of summary way of talking about making an offering. Final quotation. Train yourself in doing good that lasts and brings happiness. Cultivate generosity, the life of peace, and a mind of boundless love. I'll read it again. Train yourself in doing good that lasts and brings happiness. Cultivate generosity, the life of peace, and a mind of boundless love. That's a beautiful offering. Our own life is our offering. We make to others, we make to the universe. It's the offering that is in the time that we have, in the place where we are, with what we've been given. All right, what do you make of all that? Great.
So, over the last month or two, I've taken great comfort in the idea of making an offering. Mm-hmm. It was a situation in which I was really craving a closeness with my grandchildren, my son, my daughter-in-law, and the idea of just making an offering, and instead of, it just freed me up from craving and made it much more into curiosity.
That's great.
Instead of trying to make something happen that I thought I really wanted, it was sort of, well, I'm just not going to give up the pain of that.
Yeah.
Just sort of see what's here. And miracle of miracles, there was something actually better there than what I thought I was craving. So it was a great comfort to me. It's just very freeing.
Yeah.
I don't have to try to make the things happen. I can just make my offering and see what happens.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Great.
I was noticing the word delight, from the light. And I was thinking Sunday at the potluck, Lily came in. She had just come in from her concert. And her face was giving off this light. She was in delight.
That's good word. That's right. Out of the light. Thank you for that. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah, please.
Because there a difference between peaceable and peaceful?
That's interesting. Well, translators play with these things, and they have different angles on it. But to cut to it, well, let's see. I don't know the right answer. I can just tell you my immediate experience. When I think of peaceful, it's sort of an internal quality. And it has a kind of tranquility and a sort of, in a sense, an inertness to it. In that, the so-called noble gases, like helium, some of these other, those chemists, scientists, Mark would know, noble gases, they're called noble. Here's the funny thing, because they do not combine with other elements to form compounds. Isn't that weird? Like, there are no helium compounds, basically, because they have all the electrons at their orbits, and they're noble because they don't interact with the hoi polloi, the other elements. But there's something about peaceful. You just, and then when I think of peaceable, it more for me is about interactivity. It's in a relational field that one is peaceable, so which I think is relevant to the notion of being peaceable, friendly, and fearless. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing to explore. Yeah. Yeah, please.
I was just going to say that with the holidays, one of the things that my daughter and mother and others are very obsessed with is that capturing the moment and keeping the moment. Yeah. So the whole photo, cell phone, Snapchat, Instagram-y thing. And rather than fight that, I think just from your talk, I would say offer it first. And I found with my mom particularly, it makes such a big difference that the photo is very important to them, so do it first. Say, okay, great, well, I'll take our photo first, or let's just get that part done. So then, it's not like that while you're serving the hot food, you're holding the thing, everybody smile, there's a hot turkey and an arm, and I just, I would just say that the kids especially, they keep wanting to keep that, stay in the moment and capture it and take another photo,
were
we really all there together?
Yeah, right. That's right. Oh, but thank you. Yeah, that's really good. I know I have a version of that where I see people at these incredible events and they're holding up their phones to capture the event and they're looking at their phone the whole time to make sure they have a good camera angle, right? And instead of being with the event, and while knowing that there are 10,000 people are going to be posting the same video on YouTube that night, if you want to, that you could watch if you wanted to. Yeah. Anyway, other people, maybe how to's. Yeah.
It's not a how-to.
Oh yeah.
I want to thank you for what you've shared, especially about the word delightful. Just this last weekend, a friend said, "You're delightful to me."
Yeah.
I've never heard that word used.
Mm. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah.
What did you do?
I wasn't aware of having done anything.
Yeah. It is, to your point a moment ago about tracking words, the use of the words to me is to, they're like pointing out instructions, to be aware of distinctions in our experience, right? And it's really interesting to track the experience of delight, including the sense of delight continuously as the next moment arrives, as the next moment arises. Like, wow. Just crazy things, like being delighted in weird little stuff, like an ant carrying a crumb, or a bluebird landed next to my home office window this morning, and I was just delighted. Like, oh, bluebird, how neat. Or you can just stare at things, even without psychedelics. You can just look at them. and go, wow, paper, or staples, look. And right, and you look at the metal of a staple, and you probably know this already, but wow, the metal of that staple was made inside an exploding star. Thank you. Right? Okay. Now you can still walk and talk at the same time and run a business. Anyway, yeah.
Before we end, I was wondering if you could reread the quote with where death has no entry.
Yeah. So I'm going to do that. So, and a little bit of context that I think you're already aware of, which is that the Buddha was, how can I put this? His practice very much was to find a reliable basis for profound and lasting well-being and inner peace. And he tried practice after practice after practice, and he had extraordinary attainments as a yogic superstar, but it all faded. It all was conditioned. It all passed away. It wasn't durable because it was conditioned. It was impermanent. That which is subject to arising is subject to passing away. And thus, the passing away as well of death. So he was enormously interested in that which is not subject to passing away, that which does not have an arising either, therefore that which is timeless. He was very acutely aware of time in the sense of impermanence, and he was profoundly interested in what is outside of the natural frame of ordinary reality, in which there are causes and conditions that arise and pass away, and where there is death. So there are these words that are attempts to point out what's wordless by definition. The unconditioned, the stainless, that which is not subject to decay, the island in the river of changes, these are metaphors that were used, and the deathless. He's speaking to the transcendental. Others who are engaged with describing the transcendental might imbue the transcendental with more qualities, such as consciousness or love or happiness or perhaps some kind of omniscient personality. In the more in traditions that do that, he was pretty austere about it, and he would continually undermine people's attempt to turn the unconditioned into some conditioned thing they could cling to. So he mostly described the transcendental through negation, what it's not. It's not conditioned. It's not subject to arising and passing away. Okay, so that's the larger context. So with that little background, I'll just read this again. The entire world is in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the awakened ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. It reminds me of a related saying from the Buddha, that wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser one. There may be happiness, and particularly ordinary happiness, in delighting in things that arise and pass away. The banana bread, the Golden State Warriors, a pleasure with friends, good times. It's okay. It's okay. But what the Buddha is really talking about here is that essentially that's a lesser happiness. And wisdom really is finding that ultimate happiness, he says, the greatest, highest happiness is peace. That's what he's speaking to there. That which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the awakened ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. And I'll finish on this thought, if you like, which is that in our practice is an offering in that direction. And we can relate to our practice as an offering we make in the direction of enlightenment, in the movement toward awakening. We can't control the results. Perhaps ultimately, the apple falls from the tree by grace. And yet we can tend to the causes of our own practice, making an offering of practice in the direction of that in which my mind delights, our mind delights. How about we sit for a minute and finish up? Thank you very much. Be well. See you next week.